This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement are busy negotiating in Vienna. Anger in Austria over COVID restrictions. Tens of thousands protest in Vienna against a nationwide lockdown and a sweeping vaccine mandate. And at least 70 people are dead after four tornadoes tear through the southeastern U.S. state of Kentucky. The death toll is expected to rise. Hello and welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement are busy negotiating in Vienna. Now, this is the seventh round of such talks, which Tehran says must result in the removal of sanctions against it. Iran has adopted a proactive approach, tabling two draft proposals on sanctions removal and nuclear issues. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent from the venue of the talks for an update.
At the moment, of course, these discussions are continuing. The working groups at the expert levels, talks going on between them, as well as, of course, the other delegates at the level of political directors also engaged in various negotiations on two important issues. One is sanctions removal, and the other is the nuclear commitments boom. Of course, compliance by the Americans and compliance by Iran, which can revive the JCPOA. But what are the prospects for these talks? What is the atmosphere? How are things like at the moment? We're hearing that the American delegation is going to join these talks in Vienna soon, maybe today, maybe tomorrow, although the U.S. is not directly involved in the talks. The U.S. delegation is expected to be in Vienna, led by Robert Malley. And, of course, the messages will be conveyed to the Americans. The Americans' message will be conveyed to the EU coordinator, the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese. And we'll see where things are headed from that stage on. But earlier, we talked to Iran's lead negotiator, Deputy Foreign Minister, Mr. Ali Bagheri-Kani, and asked him a few questions about where the talks are at this stage, and of course, Iran's positions. So let's go and take a listen now to that interview, and then I'll be back.
در پیشنویسی که حاصل گفتگوهای وینه 6 هست، پس از 6 دور گفتگو.
In the draft text that was a product of the Vienna 6 negotiations, after 6 round of talks, several points of difference have remained, which require decision making at the highest levels. These issues are still on the table, unresolved. Throughout the negotiations that began on November 29th, we stated our viewpoints about various issues, including the removal of sanctions, nuclear measures, verification, guarantees, and other issues. Over the past few days, some of these issues were accepted by the opposite side, and some others were not. Therefore, we will naturally have some other issues as the main topics that should not be too many. They will form the core of serious negotiations at the level of senior negotiators of Iran and the P4+1 countries. In the new round of talks, we will make no prejudgments about the conduct of the Americans. We will wait to see their new approach in this round, and we will then make judgments accordingly. We have a basic red line, which is backed up by logic. The two sides share common ground. We have an agreement that was finalized by Iran and the P5+1 in 2015. The US withdrew from it a few years later, and now it wants to rejoin the deal. So this agreement is a shared basis between the two sides. Therefore, we will definitely agree to nothing less than that agreement, and this will certainly be a red line for the Islamic Republic of Iran. There is an obvious logic that is quite clear for the other side.
So that was, as you heard there, the lead Iranian negotiator, Deputy Foreign Minister, Mr. Ali Bagheri Kani. We were speaking to him earlier today. He's still going to be engaged in various meetings and discussions with the various delegations here in Vienna. We still don't know when this seventh round of talks is going to come to an end. But just to make some clarifications here, because we had some Western media reports claiming, particularly yesterday, that Iran has withdrawn from some of its positions. Again, both sources close to the Iranian team, Mr. Bagheri himself, have made it clear that Iran's proposals are still on the table. What is important is that all the delegations, EU officials have also confirmed this, all the delegations, of course, are here to put forward their viewpoints, their proposals. What's important is for the sides to use the space here around the negotiating table to try and hammer things out. But Iran says if there is the political will and seriousness from the Americans to remove all the sanctions, including the maximum pressure sanctions imposed under former President Donald Trump, then things can make rapid progress. And Iran is willing to go back to the 2015 deal, but it considers those additional sanctions under Trump to be jeopardizing the JCPOA because their stated objective, Iranian officials say, was exactly this. So if that decision is made, they say, and the Americans show that will, then these talks will make progress. We'll have to see if that indeed will happen.
We have hardly ever seen a country enforce the resignation of a minister in another country. Well, that's a statement by Lebanon's former information minister, who resigned earlier this month amid pressure from Riyadh and its allies. George Kodai stressed that his resignation was a bargaining chip that French President Emmanuel Macron used to open talks with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He says he would have not resigned if his country had not faced an economic crisis. Well, the former minister said he had to put Lebanon's national interests first. Kodai also noted that the Saudis have no problem with his statements. They take issue with Hezbollah's presence in Lebanese politics. He made the remarks in an exclusive interview with Iran's Al Alam TV channel. An audio from Kodai was released in November in which he criticized Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Riyadh was infuriated by the comments and took a series of punitive measures against Beirut, with several Arab states following suit. Well, Iran has reported nearly 1,700 new coronavirus infections, the lowest in more than a year. Well, the figure brings the total number of COVID cases from the beginning to around 6.1 million. 58 people have died of COVID in the span of the last 24 hours, taking that overall number of fatalities since the beginning of COVID to 130,000. Coronavirus figures have been on a downward trend since the government started a mass vaccination campaign. Some 110 million jabs have been administered, 59 million for first dosage and 50 million for second doses. Meanwhile, anger is flaring up in Austria over COVID restrictions. Tens of thousands have taken to the streets in the capital, Vienna, again to protest a nationwide lockdown and a sweeping vaccine mandate. Protesters gathered at Vienna's main square, carrying signs with slogans such as "No to vaccinations" and "Enough is enough." This is the latest in a series of protests against the government's coronavirus measures. Now, the rallies broke out late last month after the government imposed a national lockdown to squelch a fresh resurgence of the pandemic. There are also plans to make COVID vaccinations compulsory from February. Now, the mandate will apply to people 14 and over, with holdouts facing fines of up to $4,000 every 3 months. Meanwhile, the coronavirus pandemic is taking its toll on Europe, where the situation is deteriorating due to the new variant Omicron. Britain reported more than 54,000 new infections and 132 deaths. Authorities there also posted 630 new cases of Omicron. In Italy, some 21,000 new cases were diagnosed and 96 people died from the disease. Russia registered over 30,000 new infections and nearly 1,200 fatalities. The figures have prompted officials all across Europe to take extra measures to stem the deadly virus. Those include Italy, Poland, and Germany. Well, massive storms shooting off tornadoes have ravaged large parts of the central U.S., killing more than 70 people in the state of Kentucky alone.
We are nearing the end of the most severe tornado event in Kentucky's history. Multiple tornadoes have touched down, and we have damage in, I believe, over a dozen Kentucky counties. The primary tornado was on the ground continuously for over 200 miles in our state, something we have never seen before. We have deaths in multiple, possibly many counties.
Well, the governor has declared a state of emergency and deployed nearly 200 National Guard. Four tornadoes ripped through Kentucky, with the town of Mayfield being the worst hit. And the National Weather Service registered at least 36 tornado touchdowns across 6 days. In Illinois, two people died after a massive warehouse collapsed. Casualties were also reported in the state of Arkansas. Rescue teams are still searching for survivors in several states. The massive storm also knocked out power to some 300,000 consumers across seven states. President Biden has expressed his sympathy to the people and called the deadly tornadoes an unimaginable tragedy. Well, the United States always proclaims itself a leader for promoting democracy worldwide. The administration of President Joe Biden has held a two-day event, calling it the Summit for Democracy. Russia and China have accused Washington of exhibiting a Cold War mentality.
The controversial two-day U.S. Summit for Democracy has been concluded. The event was held virtually with over 100 countries in attendance.
So let's raise up our ambitions and rise up to meet the challenges together. Thank you, and I look forward to following through in the next year on all the commitments that we're making individually. Thank you.
The U.S. faced scrutiny over how it went about deciding which countries to invite. China and Russia were the highest-profile names left off the invite list. China was especially upset because it was not invited, whereas China was. The island is a major source of contention between China and the U.S. over Washington's military and political support for Taiwan that seeks independence from mainland China.
In efforts to maintain its hegemonistic status, the U.S. has abused the public idea of democracy to serve its selfish interests, instigated division and confrontation under the pretext of democracy, sabotaged the UN-centered international system and the international order based on international law, which are all outright acts against democracy.
Beijing slammed Washington over seeking to use democracy as a pretext for imposing hegemony. China says the U.S. is using democracy as a weapon of mass destruction to interfere in other countries. Russia also accuses the Biden administration of exhibiting a Cold War mentality that will stoke up ideological confrontation in the world. Questions have been raised on why the U.S. should hold such a summit, a country accused of rights violations at home and abroad. At home, Washington is suffering from problems like racial injustice that has stirred massive nationwide protests over the killing of innocent African Americans. The U.S. has also been criticized for its controversial election system, which is not based on popular vote. A recent Harvard University poll found that over 50% of young people in the U.S. believe that the country's democracy is in trouble. Abroad, the U.S. is the major supporter of Israel, which has occupied Palestinian lands and unleashed atrocities and wars on Palestinian people. It is also the main supplier of arms to countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The two countries are involved in the Yemen conflict that has left tens of thousands of innocent people dead. The U.S. itself has also invaded countries like Iraq and Afghanistan under the pretext of bringing democracy and fighting terrorism. But death and destruction have been the only outcome. Many believe that the U.S. describes only its allies as democratic countries just because they comply with its foreign policy dictates and policies. It also resorts to undemocratic means and weaponizes democracy as a tool to pressure countries to align themselves with Washington's interests.
Now to Europe, where the UK says it has granted another 23 licenses to French fishermen to resolve a post-Brexit dispute over fishing rights. Well, the licenses were agreed to late on Friday after British officials met EU counterparts and ensured vessels qualified to work in UK waters. This after a December 10th deadline set by the EU. France has not commented about the latest development, but prior to this, Paris had asked for licenses for 104 of its boats so that they could operate in British and Channel Island waters. Under last year's Brexit deal, under the agreement, EU fishermen can continue to work in British waters if they can prove that they used to fish there. Now, Paris and London have been at loggerheads for months over how many licenses French fishermen should get. Well, the UK High Court ruled on Friday that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange can be extradited to the U.S. to face espionage charges. This overturns a court ruling earlier this year and follows U.S. assurances about his treatment. His wife has slammed the verdict as a grave miscarriage of justice, saying an appeal will be launched. Advocates of press freedom have also voiced alarm at the ruling. Reporters Without Borders are warning about the implications for journalism and press freedom worldwide. The 50-year-old Australian is wanted in the U.S. for publishing classified military and diplomatic cables. If convicted, he could face up to 175 years in prison. Assange was arrested at the Ecuadorian embassy in London in 2019 after being holed up there for 7 years. Richard Medhurst says the United States is trying to make an example of Assange in order to intimidate other journalists.
The U.S. is basically extraterritorializing its laws. It's saying that even if you don't live in the United States, you don't work in the United States, you're not from the United States, if you publish documents the United States doesn't like, they will come get you. And, you know, you can be threatened with 175 years in jail. And they're trying to make an example out of him to scare other people. That's the point that they're making here. At the same time, I just argue one thing. Ironically, in a sense, although Assange's case is unique, it's not unique in terms of assurances because the United States always does this. It always lies to other countries. It lies to other judges, to other jurisdictions, in order to get people into the U.S. And, you know, whether it's through the courts or by kidnapping and rendition, which we've seen the U.S. do a lot, they just kidnap people overseas and render them they bring them to the United States. One way or another, they will find a way to get people in U.S. jurisdiction because they know once you're there, no one is going to help you, no one is going to do anything. And that's the message they're sending here. It's that other countries need to stay in line. You need to hand over anyone we ask you to hand over, whether it takes 10 years, 15 years, you're going to hand them over. And journalists should be scared of publishing documents the U.S. doesn't like.
And with that brings us to the end of this Worldness edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The reality is that the U.S. military campaign in Syria, from arming the very armed groups it is ostensibly at war with, to its massive undercounting and denial of civilian casualties, has been a dismal display of illegality and failure, says Kate Kaiser Ryder in an article published under the heading, "The U.S. military can't be trusted to investigate civilian casualties." Stay tuned for more. The U.S. Central Command has reported recently a U.S. drone strike in Idlib, Syria, against a senior member of al-Qaeda. The U.S. Central Command reported recently a drone strike in Idlib, Syria, against a senior member of al-Qaeda, rather than against a member of Daesh. The ostensible legal justification, the United States is even in Syria. Even more interestingly, CENTCOM claimed it immediately self-reported one civilian casualty that is investigating. But U.S. policymakers should not defer to the military's investigatory promises given its history of covering up or not sufficiently accounting for civilian casualties. In fact, the Associated Press has since reported that the strike wounded a family of six, including a 10-year-old child. With such over-the-horizon strikes likely to become a key component of Team Biden's rebranded counterterrorism strategy, the National Security Committees in Congress have a duty to comprehensively review and interrogate the strategic and human cost of this approach. This latest strike, rather than a one-off, appears to be a part of a pattern of drone attacks in Idlib, in spite of the administration's claimed moratorium on drone strikes during its counterterrorism review. In late September, military officials revealed it had carried out a drone strike in the province earlier that month against another alleged member of al-Qaeda while claiming no civilian casualties. It's no coincidence that CENTCOM appears to have proactively taken responsibility for this latest civilian casualty. This incident came at the end of a week of rightful public uproar after the New York Times revealed the U.S. military's apparent cover-up of an airstrike killing 80 civilians in eastern Syria in 2019. Rather than allowing more exhaustive investigative journalism to uncover its destructive and deadly actions in Syria, it appears CENTCOM is hoping that announcing an investigation will stave off an intense media frenzy like the one following its botched August 29th drone strike in Kabul during the withdrawal from Afghanistan that killed Zamari Ahmadi, a civilian electrical engineer, and his family. What's new about the recent Idlib strike is not that the United States is droning Syria and killing civilians without congressional authorization. It's that the U.S. military is now openly engaging a region of Syria, one that's the last stronghold of armed resistance to government that it had previously avoided outside of one-off strikes due to the risk of entanglement in the broader Syrian conflict. The quick succession of these strikes appears to be a quiet expansion of the U.S. forever wars and an apparent reflection of this president's desire to make U.S. endless wars primarily remote control moving forward. You'd be forgiven if you had forgotten that the United States is in Syria at all. There is no affirmative congressional authorization for U.S. military operations in Syria, despite the United States bombing the country and occupying portions of it since late 2014, after it became clear that it could not get authorization for the use of military force against Daesh due to congressional opposition, then President Obama invoked the then 13-year-old 2001 AUMF passed to invade Afghanistan in 2001. As the U.S.-led airstrike campaign transitioned into a broader train, equip and occupy parts of eastern Syria, the United States continued drone strikes in the country without any domestic or international legal justification. The United States has been at war with a variety of adversaries in Syria. For years, endless war advocates have feared the expansion of the U.S. war in Syria to the rest of the country, particularly if war powers champions in Congress did little to challenge multiple administrations' made-up legal concept of allied as associated forces in 2001 AUMF and dubiously broad collective self-defense doctrines. That's what we are seeing happen today, and yet another administration is one again risking sleepwalking into more endless war and the associated human cost. Congress shouldn't let them get away with it and instead seize the opportunity to launch its own inquiry into U.S.-caused civilian harm in Syria, something Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is on the Senate Armed Services Committee, has already called for with regard to the 2019 Buzz strike cover-up exposed by the Times. That inquiry should not just be limited to one strike, however, but instead cover the entire U.S. air campaign in Syria following the rise of Daesh and include all of uncounted who have yet to be officially acknowledged, let alone receive justice. Congress should make the U.S. military publicly refute credible evidence of hundreds of unclaimed civilian casualties caused by the United States and U.S. supported forces since the start of the war. It should review whether airstrikes there met the requirements of the laws of war and if flattening residential areas was actually justified by the perceived threat or military objective. It should also seek to understand whether and with what frequency, if any, the United States has offered or given ex gratia or condolence payments to families it has harmed. The reality is that the United States military campaign in Syria, from arming the very armed groups it is ostensibly at war with, to its massive undercounting and denial of civilian casualties, has been a dismal display of illegality and failure.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
So, today when you look at the media all around the world, a type of harsh, violent, barbaric picture is made out of the religion of Islam, especially with the creation of such groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the suicide bombing, you know, here and there. Especially the people in the West has a wrong view regarding the religion of Islam and the true teachings of Islam. Today we want to talk about this topic, how the religion of Islam can help international bodies to establish peace all around the world. Sayyid Mursal, let's start with you, brother. Islam is really a peaceful religion, isn't it?
Well, thank you very much. If you look at the word Islam itself, it has its deep root in peace. and comfort. So these days we know that peacekeeping is a very essential and important part of everybody's life. I mean, the whole humanity needs to take refuge to peacekeeping. Otherwise, the same skirmish that we can see around the world is happening.
That's right.
And unfortunately, conflict and fights, have taken over, to many parts of the world, even very small communities around the world. So, unfortunately, some biased medias, are trying to instill this wrong idea that religious conflict is the root of all these problems around the world. And we know that it has become a very important issue these days.
Okay.
So the religion of Islam is very much interested and even is trying to disseminate this true ideology that peace and religion are together. So any religion who's trying to propagate conflict, discomfort and problems is not actually a true religion. So
that's right.
Islam is telling us that peacekeeping or keeping peace among all humanity is very essential and is necessary.
Okay, and there have been so many conversions to the religion of Islam because of the peace that it brings into the society and also at the individual mental level. You know, the people was converted, when you ask them, one of the reasons is this tranquility, calmness, and peace of mind that it brings to you. This is one individual aspect, but when you look at the societal, social, collective aspect, you can find also this kind of peace. Sayyid Mohsen, what's your comment on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, first of all, we should know that that the religion has a strong influence on the people.
Yes.
In belief and in their faith. So, and we know that the people, they cannot live without having a belief or faith. Even the atheists do have a belief on which they obviously rely. Therefore, we see different religions in the world, and we see people divided into different religions. But the Islam, as brother has said in its name, it has the word peace itself. And according to one meaning, we refer to the religion of peace. Therefore, Islam has a big contribution in order to make a peace. And obviously, it depends whether we follow the Islam in its true way or not. Because everything has two kinds of use. It can be used properly or it can be misused. So when we talk about the religion of Islam and its contribution towards the peace in the world, we can see that the Islam is the complete version of all the religions.
Okay.
And it has everything within it. And because it's the final religion, we can say, like from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mm. Therefore, it also refers to the peace as well. And on top of that, we... the slogans even in the Quran and that are given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, these are not general or general slogans. For example, when he talks about his prophet, he wants to introduce his prophet, he says he's Rahmatul Lil Alameen.
Yes.
He's the mercy for all the worlds. So the one who's mercy for all the worlds means that he is the bringer of peace to all the worlds, basically.
That's right.
So when we talk about the worlds, obviously it's different
yes.
states.
Okay.
So we can say like Islam has a big contribution if we really follow the true Islam.
That's right.
Because nowadays the problem is that the enemies are propagating against Islam
yes.
and people do not know the real source
yes.
of the Islam.
That's right. But say, Murtaza, there are still some doubts and questions regarding the misunderstanding out of the religion of Islam, because the extremist groups who are really the pioneers of showing a kind of violent, barbaric picture of Islam to the world, refer to the same text of the Holy Quran that calls Prophet Muhammad as Rahmatul Alameen. But they understood it in this way, to kill here and there, to commit suicide, and such, violent actions that are every day shown on the Western media, on the news, here and there. You can find so many clips, video clips, the audios here and there. And that's why even some of the scholars of religions in the world at the universities believe that these violent things are based on the very text of the Quran and the context in which Islam was created. What's your answer to that?
Well, actually, let's look at the wrong misinterpretation of some verses of the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, some people that you call them scholars, they have their own interpretations which has no actually base and roots in Islamic principles and ideologies. And unfortunately, we have this idea that the religious leaders who have a very crucial role in bringing peace into communities. I think it's highly important to know, and it's really good to know that we all have a very important task to establish peace among all communities. This part has been forgotten by these people, that they are just by name scholars.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they are not very much involved in interpreting the true aspects of some verses of the Holy Quran.
Okay.
So these pictures that have been broadcasted around the world are just coming from those interpretations that are not true. So if, on the other hand, we have another downside of this issue, that many scholars do not get themselves involved in providing the true interpretation of those verses and give them the information and give such information to those who are going to fight in order to bring peace, not to bring conflicts.
That's right.
So some fighting is not all about creating conflicts. People sometimes are dragged into fighting. I can call them not fight jihad because they want to bring peace. Unfortunately, this is not being interpreted correctly.
That's right. This interpretation of the verses of the Quran, and the thing is that they delete some part and they add some part to the verses of the Holy Quran. The context in which that verse was revealed is not known to them. And if you look at the history and how much the religion of Islam could help establishing peace among the families and the societies on the Arab Peninsula at the time of Prophet Muhammad, it would be really beautiful from the side of the scholars. But Sayyid Mohsen, still, as I said, there are some commentaries written on the verses of the Holy Quran and the incidents, especially after the demise of the Prophet Muhammad, about the wars that took place by the Muslim leaders and the kings here and there in different lands of the societies, show that maybe Islam was spread by sword and not words. What's your answer to that, brother?
Well, the problem started right after the demise of the Prophet.
Okay.
And for your previous and the recent question which you asked, for both of them, the answer is that the main root of this diversion and this extremism that which we see like in today's world, it's because right after the demise of Prophet, there were some people who said, Hasbuna kitab Allah. The book of Allah is enough for us.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the book of Allah brings the overall or general rules and the detailed rules, and the details are in the life of the Prophet, in the narrations of the Prophet. So when they left the sunnah of the Prophet and the, we can say, the narrations of the Prophet, and they just attached, and they got the book only,
yes,
which they couldn't even understand, because the book of Allah, Quran, has in its verses there are some hidden meanings.
Yes.
There are some clear wordings. There are some mutashabih, like there are some similar,
yes,
things which are said. There are some clear, I said, like the
muhkamat and
mutashabihat have,
yes,
different meanings, obviously, as well. But obviously, there is nasakh and mansukh. There was a rule, and later by the Prophet,
yes,
it was overruled,
the
and then the new rule,
right,
came. So when we look at the Quran, it has different aspects.
Mm-hmm.
In order to understand the Quran, we need to refer back to the history of the revelation.
That's right.
Like why this verse was revealed,
okay,
upon the Prophet,
yes,
because of whom, what happened, who did what, so that the Prophet has,
yes,
said this or Allah has revealed the,
yes,
verses. So when they left all these things, these details, and they just got the book,
yes,
on its own without the teacher, without the explanation which was given by the Prophet,
yes,
we can see all those issues that happened into the Islam. And the picture today that,
yes,
we have, that Islam is spread by the sword,
yes,
this was never happened in the life of Prophet.
Yes.
Prophet never invaded any place.
Yes.
Rather, the battles which he had, it was in defense of Islam. He was defending the Muslims.
Yes.
And at that time, yes, it is true that it was out of the Medina. Why? Because at that time, whenever there used to be a battle, they used to go at a common place.
That's all right.
Which was in the middle of, like,
okay,
two countries or two places.
Okay.
So this was the reason, basically.
That's
so the main reason is when some people left the sayings of the Prophet, Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salam, which were obviously,
yes,
Allah has also emphasized,
okay,
on this, and the Prophet also said, I'm leaving amongst you two things, the Quran and Ahlul Bayt.
Mm-hmm.
So when they just got the Quran and they left Ahlul Bayt, they left the sayings of the Prophet narrations, the,
that's,
explanations,
right,
about the verses, that's what happens generally.
Okay.
And this wrong picture that today we have is because of,
that's right,
leaving the explanations given by the Prophet.
And the Ahlul Bayt also as the true exegesis of the Holy Quran. But in the 21st century, still after 14 centuries, after the revelation of the Holy Quran to Prophet Muhammad and Islam, how do you think, Sayyid Murtaza, Islam and its teachings, its true teachings, I would like to very much use this term, pure Muhammadan Islam's teachings, you know, can help international bodies like these different international bodies that are working for peace, you know. Whenever you look at the main slogans and the mottos of these organizations, you can find peace. How Islam can help them in today's world?
You know, let's look at this question from another point of view.
Okay.
So all religions, including the religion of Islam, to some extent came, and it was descended to prophets to bring peace and bring nations together. So it is a duty we all have, and this has been bestowed upon us,
yes,
that we must work very hard to teach and influence on each and every community on the earth in order to live a peaceful life and to be a follower of this peaceful life. So the religion of Islam has put a great emphasis on this aspect.
Okay.
And if you can see, wherever we have gatherings, meetings, the first thing that is been mentioned by the speakers and those leaders, especially religious leaders, is the unity.
Yes.
So when we talk about unity and the united nation, so it means that Islam is putting its greatest slogan and mottos on unity. So unity is not happening without understanding, without mutual understanding,
yes,
especially about religious matters.
That's right.
So the religion of Islam is focusing on similarities.
That's right.
The differences are not going to be given the first priority.
Okay.
So similarities bring people together.
Right.
So this aspect is the one that Islam has been propagated and has been talked about this matter over centuries.
That's all right. Especially as you said, reaching a kind of common ground among the Islamic leaders between themselves and also the leaders of the other religious communities and being united is a really important one. You know, the meetings that are happening today and the dialogue, both interfaith and intrafaith dialogues that are taking place and established in today's world, show that all religious leaders are after making this peace in the world and not the conflict. But unfortunately, this media and the power of the media is showing it the way around.
And of course, you know that we need to work in order to build relationships.
Yes.
And relations of trust.
Okay.
With other religions.
Yes.
And this is what Islam has been always doing. You know, okay, over the past centuries, we had our infallible imams,
yes,
Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And on top of all, we have the Book of Islam, Quran, is telling us and its followers that a amicable relationship with other religions and with other followers of the other religions is really of a great importance.
That's all right.
So this shows that Islam has already said clearly that peace with and to other nations and anyone is very important.
That's all right. Said Mohsen, thank you very much, brothers, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints regarding how the religion of Islam can establish peace in today's world. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, view our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taken my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today. Yeah. Allah.
Insightful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In England, the Prime Minister now talks about compulsory vaccinations just 6 months after proclaiming Freedom Day from coronavirus restrictions. In Germany, the new Chancellor has endorsed barring unvaccinated people from much of public life. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Mark Landler, Christopher Schutz, and Emma Bobola. The piece is titled Vaccine Mandates Rekindle Fierce Debate Over Civil Liberties. Please stay with us for more. The Prime Minister now talks about compulsory vaccinations just 6 months after proclaiming Freedom Day from coronavirus restrictions. In Germany, the new Chancellor has endorsed barring unvaccinated people from much of public life. Next door in Austria, the unvaccinated will remain confined to their homes, even after the government lifts a lockdown on Sunday. Across Europe's democracies, the latest wave of the pandemic is prompting governments to reimpose sweeping restrictions on free movement and mixing in their societies. Only this time, many of the rules single out those who are not vaccinated. That has stirred angry street protests and rekindled a searing debate over how much countries should curtail individual liberties in the name of public health. Some of the most abrupt reversals are occurring in countries where the laws and culture cherish the sanctity of personal rights. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's new measures kicked off a mutiny in his own Conservative Party, with lawmakers calling his embrace of vaccine passes discriminatory and an affront to the country's hallowed principles. Similar protests echo in France and Germany. The backlash plays out vividly every weekend on the streets of Vienna, Austria, where tens of thousands of protesters march, some brandishing placards that say, "Control our borders, not our people." Demonstrators have also clashed with the police over restrictions in Belgium, Germany, and the Netherlands. "The civil liberties argument has ebbed and flowed," said Adam Wagner, a London-based human rights lawyer and expert on COVID-related laws. "The risk with the move toward vaccine passports is that it radicalizes libertarians and vaccine skeptics. That people are still arguing about how to weigh these competing values nearly 2 years after the pandemic began," Adam Wagner said, "suggests we haven't really come up with any great solutions." Many in Europe have proven to be surprisingly tolerant about the need to sacrifice some freedoms to curb the spread of the virus. But the sudden threat of new Omicron variant is pushing countries like Britain, which only last summer had celebrated an end to lockdowns, to lurch back in the direction of restrictions. Boris Johnson and other European leaders are being driven by two unforgiving medical trends. The rapid spread of the Omicron variant, which British scientists estimate is doubling at the rate of every 2 to 3 days, and a stubborn resistance to vaccines in segments of their societies, which has left roughly a third of people across Europe more vulnerable to another wave of infections. Defenders of vaccine passes point out that they drove up the vaccination rate in France, another country that jealously guards its rights. But to critics, the targeted nature of these restrictions imposes a stigma on one part of society that carries disquieting echoes in Germany and Austria, where right-wing protesters invoke the Nazi boot to claim that the state is persecuting those who resist vaccines. It's polarizing and divisive in the sense that it creates a society of us versus them, which is a very dangerous proposition, I think, said Clifford Stott, a professor of social psychology at Keele University in England. We are creating a recipe for disorder by amplifying structural inequalities. People who have not been vaccinated or actively resist vaccines tend to be poorer and less well-educated than those who have, Mr. Stott said. Many already distrust the government, forcing their compliance by sequestering them at home or depriving them of access to bars and restaurants is only likely to deepen their sense of grievance, he said. In some countries where leaders are scrambling to deflect harsh criticism, suspicion about their motives is even more acute. Boris Johnson imposed fresh restrictions, including a requirement to show proof of vaccination to get into cinemas, theatres or sports stadiums, amid a furore over a holiday gathering his staff held last year that may have flouted lockdown rules. It was, said one lawmaker, a diversionary tactic. Undaunted, Boris Johnson said it was time to have a national conversation about whether to make vaccination compulsory, a step Austria has taken and Germany seems poised to follow. Britain, he said, could not afford to keep imposing lockdowns just because a substantial proportion of the population still sadly has not got vaccinated. With 70% of people having received two shots, Britain's vaccination rate is comparable to that of France and Germany. Jonathan Sumption, a former justice on Britain's Supreme Court, who has been an outspoken critic of lockdown restrictions, said it was unlikely, given the country's civil liberties tradition, that Britain would ever follow Austria. There are things governments should not do, even if they work, he said. But Mr. Sumption said, the aggressive use of vaccine passports would have the same effect, since people will be deprived of so many rights to go about their daily lives. In Germany, the new Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who rejected mandatory vaccinations during his campaign, now backs a law that would make it compulsory. Germany has been ravaged by the Delta variant of the coronavirus, running roughly 50,000 new infections a day. Its number of vaccinated people has picked up in recent days, partly because of the fear of Omicron variant, but the slow pace has frustrated the government. You can't callously watch the situation as it is right now, Olaf Scholz said last week. If we had a higher vaccination rate, we would have a different situation. His timing was good. Germany's highest court recently ruled that lockdowns ordered by the government earlier this year were constitutional. A YouGov poll at the end of November found that 69% of the German public now supports the vaccine mandate, up from 33% a year ago. On Friday, lawmakers voted to make vaccines obligatory for healthcare workers. Still, there is palpable ambivalence about the trade-offs. Karl Lauterbach, a member of the parliament who has been hawkish on restrictions and now serves as Germany's health minister, told Der Spiegel magazine that no one would be jailed for refusing to get vaccinated. Instead, he said he envisioned fines for those who refuse vaccination. Regardless, the debate is likely to bring more people into the streets. In Saxony, for example, in eastern Germany, thousands have set off on nightly walks to protest both restrictions and vaccinations. The protests have become more violent, and among those marching are far-right figures who are exploiting the anger. A recent study of civil liberties during the pandemic by scholars from Harvard and Stanford universities found that people who lived in parts of Germany that belonged to the communist East before reunification, like in Saxony, were less likely than other Germans to countenance any infringement of their rights. What's not clear, experts said, is whether these protests will peter out, as have previous demonstrations. Ulrich Wagner, a professor of social psychology at the University of Marburg, argued that paradoxically, a law forcing vaccinations could end up shaking people out of their opposition to them. Mandatory vaccination is a clear prescription, and from a psychological point of view, it makes it easier to be brought around, Professor Wagner said. The far right plays an even more conspicuous role in fueling the protests in Austria. Herbert Kickl, the leader of the right-wing Freedom Party, is a featured speaker at the weekly rallies in Vienna. Despite being stricken with COVID symptoms 2 weeks ago, he promised to lead the largest demonstration ever on Saturday. A few marchers have even fixed a yellow Star of David to their coats, suggesting they somehow suffer the same persecution as the Jews under Hitler. Still, said Jürgen Freund, a former member of the European Parliament from Austria, it is a strange mix. There are also families with small children who claim that the sanctity of their body is under threat, he said. Those who subscribe to esotericism and homeopathic drugs. Austria's vaccination rate at 67% is among the lowest in Europe. It too has been suffering through its most serious wave of COVID yet, and there is quiet support for the restrictions. Austria announced a 20-day lockdown and a mandatory vaccination on the same day in November. Some countries appear to have struck a fitful balance between freedom and public health. When Italy required workers in October to obtain a green pass certifying their vaccination status, protests erupted across the country. Hundreds of port workers gathered to block trucks in the northeastern Italian city of Trieste. But the unrest subsided after a few weeks, and most Italians now accept having a green pass as a condition to go to bars and restaurants. Some experts say Italy's gradual approach laid the groundwork for even tighter restrictions.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.